Hey, Megan, Dr. G here with SPKN, the Sport Professional Knowledge Network. And today we welcome Megan Bartlett. Besides having the best name in the entire world, she is the founder of the Center for Healing and Justice Through Sport, an organization formerly known as We Coach. Megan has spent most of her career working in, designing, and advocating for programs that use sport to promote youth development and that positively impact communities. Co-author of the book, Redesigning Youth Sports, Change the Game, Megan has just released a kid's book about trauma, aptly named A Kid's Book About Trauma. Megan, welcome to SPKN.
Hey there, thanks for having me.
I know I go by Meg, but it is short for Megan, so I'm with you on that. That's a great—
Outnumbered today, Dr. G.
That's right, you got Megan.
I'm outnumbered every day, don't worry.
Well, we always like to start way in the beginning. And so we thought, you know, why don't we start with what is trauma and how do people experience it?
Yeah, great question.
I came up with that one.
Good job.
You know, I think there are very clinical definitions of what trauma is, but I think that sort of more useful definition of trauma is that it's the kind of stress that overwhelms you, the kind of stress that is sort of beyond your capacity to do the things you need to do to respond to it. And that's what sort of makes trauma, trauma. There are lots of ways that people experience trauma. And I think what's interesting about it and what I think is useful for people to know is that we tend to only think about trauma as big, overwhelming, sort of terrible events, right? We think about big natural disasters. We think about devastating car crashes or devastating loss on a scale that is sort of abrupt and big. And that is trauma. That is traumatic, right? Those things are traumatic, but so are a lot of other things that maybe we don't think of in the same way. The experience of living in communities where you don't always feel safe walking around, uncertainty of knowing whether or not there will be food on the table when you get home, an immigration status that puts you or your family at risk in a community where they're looking to regulate those kinds of things. So trauma is all of those experiences. And I think what's challenging about it is that what's traumatic for some people is not necessarily traumatic for others, right? An event that overwhelms you might not overwhelm me, and an event that overwhelms me might not overwhelm Dr. G. And so this is why the experience of trauma and the signs of the impact of trauma are so important to understand, because we can't always sort of make rational sort of assessments of whether or not someone's experienced something traumatic.
So, I mean, listening to that, and I don't know much about trauma as well, I'm curious to talk more that, you know, that would make, that as a scientist or a researcher, that would make studying trauma very challenging if we can't clearly define it or operationalize it. So measuring it anyway, whether that be quantitative or qualitative or some sort of, right. So can you speak more to that then? I mean, how do we know if it's there?
Yeah. And I think you're exactly right. Part of what is really challenging about trauma is that it is individualized in lots of ways, right? A lot of how we're impacted by trauma is affected by how we've, the experiences we've had, right? So if, you know, Dr. G, you and I are both in a, what might be sort of objectively considered traumatic experience, say we're both in a building that catches fire and we have to make a dramatic escape from that building. Our experiences previous to that traumatic event will have a huge impact on how we experience that event. if we're a person who has had a lot of supports in our lives, had a lot of relational connection and a lot of sort of the good stress in our lives, then our ability to deal with something like that traumatic event is significantly different than if we had had a set of experiences that were sort of overwhelming or chaotic or severe or sort of other traumatic events. And so to your point about how hard it is to understand whether or not what someone is experiencing is traumatic, that's the real challenge in working with any person, but particularly as a coach, if you're working with 25 people who are experiencing everything differently. And so there are definitely some common things that we see from people who've been impacted by trauma. We see what they tend to have sort of disproportionate reactions to stressful circumstances, right? They tend to experience things that maybe we can sort of rationalize as the everyday stress of a sport experience, right? We're just, you know, you're learning how to hit a curveball, let's say, right? And some kids sort of manage the stress of learning how to hit a curveball because it's just the normal stress of, you know, sport. You're getting, maybe you're a little outside your comfort zone, but that's how we grow. And so that they sort of have a, maybe they're a little frustrated. Maybe they're, you know, they sort of have what feels like a normal response to that amount of added stress. Young people who've experienced trauma typically have a disproportionate amount of, or disproportionate reaction to that. So they're the kids who throw their bats. They're the kids who, in very unexpected circumstances, they're the kids who quit out of nowhere because this thing that to the rest of us feels like it's not that big of a deal, feels like a huge deal to them.
This is interesting to me because I've been trying to figure out, you know, this mental toughness and mental health and the difference between that. And you've got, as you mentioned, good stress. I mean, yep. I think we should
totally
find what that is.
Yeah.
I didn't know stress could be good. No.
No. Well, and I think that's really important because after the last couple of years of dealing with the pandemic, I think more people are becoming more aware of the impact of stress on folks, right? And how it can have a negative impact on your mental health. And we keep seeing studies come out that say children are struggling with mental health issues. All of those things are true and should be concerning. And the answer to that is not no stress, mm-hmm. right? The opposite of overwhelming stress is not no stress. It's the right dosing of stress. It's the right kinds of stress. So Meg, to your point about what's good stress is stress that's controlled, moderate, and predictable. Stress that you have some control over, some stress that you sort of can predict is going to happen, and that it doesn't stretch you too far beyond your comfort zone, right? Stretching a little beyond your comfort zone is necessary for learning, right? We mm-hmm. have to try new things. We have to do things that we aren't currently able to do. But you need that stress to be in the right doses. And anybody who's a sport person knows about that from a sport skill development perspective, right? But the same is true from a sort of stress perspective as well, when we're thinking about it from a more psychological perspective. Because stress that's severe, prolonged, or chaotic creates vulnerability, and stress that's moderate, controlled, and predictable creates resilience.
Do you get the feeling we're going too far in one direction where, I mean, I found in talking to kids that they're like, wait, you know, we're not supposed to be happy all the time. We're not supposed to be, you know, right. De-stressed all the time. Totally. I think they kind of have gone too far the other direction, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's natural when a young person is struggling, or when we sort of see the rise of stress on this sort of societal level, for us to want to fix it, for us to want to intervene, for us to want to, you know, I always think about it as like when I know for, in particular, some of the young people I've coached, they've had too much happen to them in their short lives, right? And all you want to do is wrap them up in bubble wrap and hope nothing bad ever happens to them again, right? You know, but really, you might be able to keep them from further harm, but you won't help them heal, right? Because healing involves the doses of stress, the ability to tolerate stress. Trauma sort of wires our brain in a way that makes us overreactive to stress. And if we dose stress in the right way, then we build up this resilience again. And so we can get back on sort of, you know, quote unquote, normal patterns, normal reactions to stress.
Other than trauma. So let's say we have a player that's overreacting and we're like, oh, maybe there's something there. Are there other things that child could be going through that would also show those things? I mean, is it always trauma? We've got, you know, you've got stress, you've got anxiety disorders, you've got trauma. And so where does it all kind of lay out? Obviously, as coaches, I want to say we're not diagnosing anyone.
Yeah, exactly.
So let's put that out there right away.
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, that's sort of what I was going to say to start is that in some ways, I think it matters less what's causing it and more about how the behavior is presenting itself and sort of then how we respond, right? I think the change that is important from our perspective that we want to see is that a lot of coaches that see things that they don't want to see, that reactive behavior, those disruptive things in team dynamics, the assumption is that a young person is sort of doing it on purpose, right? That there's some intent behind it. And so I think number one, to your point, step back and say, there's probably more to this story than we think. And number two, the answer isn't necessarily, you know, convince them to do something different. It's what skill are they missing that's keeping them from doing that thing? And how can we build that skill? Right. So if it's that they're struggling with anxiety, if it's a history of trauma, if it's just truly like an elevated period of stress for a young person that, you know, all of us have had bad days when we're particularly stressed, and we might not call that trauma. But whatever it is, I think it's so important for us to think about that behavior is telling us something about an unmet need for a young person, right? For some reason, and whatever that reason is, it's causing them to have this disproportionate reaction. What do they need to practice in order to get better so that that doesn't happen again? Right? What is it that, what is the skill they're missing? Not, you know, sort of how do we break their will?
Before I go on to skill development and a few kind of other key things, what would be the signs, the symptoms, and the prevalence if we think about trauma? So as coaches, leaders, organizers, right? What am I looking for as one of those right individual level characteristics of manifesting trauma at practice, wherever it may be?
Again, part of the challenge of this is that individual reactions look different based on individuals, but generally the experience of trauma affects our brain in a way that a set of regulatory networks in our brain that are known as the stress response system, conveniently, right? The stress response system is what deals with it. And so when the stress response system goes off, basically it's telling your brain that you're under threat. And when your brain is under threat, when your systems of sort of defense go up, the parts of your brain that get engaged are the sort of lower back parts of your brain that are more functional. You're sort of functionally driven towards survival and reaction and emotion as opposed to cognition, right? So lower middle parts of your brain, as you sort of move up your brain, become more sophisticated and more cognitively focused. when your stress response system is saying, hey, alert, 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 every, you know, you've got to be on guard, then you start to have much more survival based reactions, which look like fight, flight, freeze, and or sort of reactive, disproportionate emotional reactions that don't fit the circumstance. And so the one of the major differences in a young person who's been affected by adversity or trauma is that their stress response system is more likely to be on, right? It's more likely to be activated. It's more likely that they are a kid who looks like they're on guard all the time. And I think a lot of us, when we think about it, we know what that kid looks like. If they're not sort of constantly in that state, then we see it in these episodes of disproportionate behavior, which can also be totally shutting down, right? One of the other responses that our body does to overwhelming stress is something called dissociation. And dissociation is basically the process of separating yourself from your experience, right? And so this is why this is why someone will break the 2-hour marathon, is because they're good at dissociating, right? Because your body shouldn't be able to do that, but you can do something. Basically, you can teach your brain to not feel the pain. And so dissociation can be used as a good and like adaptive reaction, but dissociation in a young person who's experienced a lot of trauma is really hard to tell it's there, because the kid sort of looks like they're looking at you and maybe are being compliant, but they're not responding in a way that, I mean, they're not taking in any of that information because they're still living in this emotional reactive part of the brain and not in the cognitive part of the brain. Mm-hmm. One of the other things that I think if this is happening with a young person, it's worth considering that it may be, that there may be something deeper involved, is I don't know how many coaches I've talked to, but a very, very high percentage of them can think of a kid who they sort of think, I know that kid knows better in whatever the decision-making is. And the challenge is, yeah, they probably do when they're calm enough that their stress response system isn't activated and telling them to act from the lower part of their brain, right? When a young person has a really hard time getting into the cognitive part of their brain, and when they're calm and sort of looking at you, they can tell you exactly what play they were supposed to run. But when they're out there and the stress sort of increases, how much they've been able to practice performing under that amount of stress has a huge impact on whether or not they can do it. And if you don't have sort of good patterns of stress, if your brain is used to overreacting, if your wiring has been sort of messed up by trauma, then it's much harder to get back into a normal pattern like that. It can be done. That's the beautiful thing about the brain, right? The brain is like a muscle, in that it's plastic and use dependent, right? It can always change, and the parts that you use the most become the strongest, but you need to practice.
I'm just thinking of coaches, right? So what I'm struggling or I'm thinking about now is normal sort of anxiety and normal, maybe for most people, normal doses of stress. Yeah. And just the overall pressure to perform and wanting to perform, right? So I coach right now eighth grade football. So I've got that top of my mind, and I've got eighth graders that, you know, sometimes you think that, right, have you lost your mind?
Well, and already developmentally, they're operating more out of their emotional part of their brain, right? That because the brain develops from the back to the front, in along the life cycle of their brain, they're operating more out of their emotional parts of their brain than their cognitive already, right? So when you're dealing with eighth grade boys, you're already dealing with that kind of, you've already got some more stuff firing in that brain than you would otherwise. But yes, for sure.
Yeah. So we've got anxiety. We've got some normal stress. They're trying to impress the coaches, maybe impress a family member. You know, they're cognitively, they're processing a lot during a particular play. And we try to make it simple, right? Like, this is all you really need to do. Do this right here. And then, you know, during the moment of the play, they completely don't do the things that you think you've practiced and rehearsed.
Totally.
I guess, you know, for myself and others that are eighth grade coaches and others, right? Should I be concerned about trauma compared to the normal sort of kind of demands of sport? And, or it sounds like if I'm aware of trauma and overwhelming a system anyway, I can bring that back into practice somehow for everybody to help them calm down, anticipate, predict, perform. And it seems to, and this is the last thing I'm gonna stop talking, is when I do things at practice, and I think not just because I'm physically larger and bigger and have rehearsed it though, the game slows down for me in such a way that it's much more predictable and that I don't get so worked up about things. And I see that in more skilled performers too. And I'm just kind of connecting some dots going, you know, I think there's something here for me to consider. And I've been doing some mindfulness practices or just deep breathing and other relaxation stuff for the team. Not for me, Meg. I mean, I'm not doing that stuff.
I was like, wait, I think misheard that.
But I'm trying to get them to, in the moment of the game and during a play, as well as afterwards, be able to tune it up and as well, you know, turn it up and turn it down a little bit and adjust and regulate. So I wonder what you think about that. It says, like, I see you smiling too. So I know you're ready to jump on this thing.
A couple of things that you said, I think are really important for coaches to understand and for how to make this applicable, right? I think of a team, a group of young people as being sort of along a continuum of how stress impacts them. Right. So every young person shows up at your practice somewhere along a stress continuum, somewhere along an arousal continuum. And most young people who are pretty normally regulated, well-regulated young people are somewhere in the sort of calm to alert phase of arousal when they get to you. How quickly certain stressful situations push kids beyond their tolerance of stress is one of the sort of indications of how sensitized they are to stress. And so thinking about it, I loved what you said about sort of turning up and turning down. That skill is useful for everyone, regardless of where they start on the continuum and even how sensitive to movement on the continuum they are. That skill is really useful. Some kids are going to need it in the bottom of the ninth, bases loaded, you know, two outs, because that's the that's what it takes to push them outside their comfort zone. Some kids get pushed outside their comfort zone running a scrimmage play on any given day. And on any given day, it might be because something's going on at school that day that, you know, usually they can tolerate it, but today's just one of those days and they can't tolerate it that day. Having those skills of being able to regulate themselves, of being able to sort of understand where they are on that continuum and where they want to be on that continuum and what gets them there on that continuum, I think is the really important piece. Because in sport, unfortunately, we make assumptions that everybody needs the same things to move along that continuum. Right. So we assume everybody's starting at the same baseline and therefore needs the same set of warmups, needs the same set of hype speech, needs the same set of whatever it is to get ready for a game. And we know in practice, we were just talking to a college crew coach, and she was talking about a player she had. She was sort of listening to what we said about the brain and sort of understanding, oh, it's actually not normal for one of my players to throw up before every race, right? But what they do to hype up for that race, most of her team can tolerate and one kid can't, right? This kid can't tolerate that. So she has this physical reaction to that stress. What you're saying about the strategies to regulate yourself, to be conscious of and move along intentionally along the continuum is really what we're trying to get folks to do. And to understand that some kids really are just much more sensitive and get pushed into sort of fear and terror in a way that it would take much more for other kids to get to that point, right? That some doses of stress that seem totally manageable to us actually push kids beyond where they can tolerate it.
It reminds me of the summertime. We had some summer conditioning and we had a new kid join the team. And he had, I think, just tried out, and I was watching the tryouts, and I, you know, identified that the league wanted me to pick a few kids that we could have join our team. And this kid came to one of our warmups, and so we said hello, we introduced ourselves, and he's about into the fourth, you know, drill of high knees and back pedal, and he needed a little break already. He was getting gassed, and that was the last day that we saw him. And I hated it, right? I hated it. I reached out to the family and inquired. And I don't know if he ended up playing kind of down at the next level or, you know, is this going to wait and maybe get in so-called better shape? But it was like, man, like, you know, we try to kind of do what we thought to be welcoming and just get started and also acknowledge that, you know, people are coming in at different places and we want them there.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, you know, they made the decision to leave it at that moment.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think we lose kids like that a lot. And I think what we're trying to help coaches see is, are there some additional ways that we can, you know, one of the things that we say to coaches is like one more kid for one more day, right? Like if you can keep one more kid for one more day, then you've created an environment that allows for their different levels of stress tolerance. But there, and in some cases, it won't be a good fit, right? Like it sounds like for that kid, you all really were beyond where they were capable of tolerating. And you don't, you know, I think there are sort of reasonable expectations for coaches to make accommodations. And then there's also a limit to, you know, you couldn't plop me down in the right, what's a sport, an elite fencing program, and expect me to be able to tolerate it, right? There are things that you could do to help build my tolerance for that, but at some level, it would just be beyond my ability.
You know, my daughter was a soccer player, and she had a coach that would have one dedicated conditioning day. They had conditioning all the way through, and the goal of the day was to throw up. So you just kept going until you threw up.
Right.
And we obviously, the parents got in on that one and decided that was probably not, you know, the way to go about that. But
no,
I think this is so important because it talks to why you need to know the kids on your team and really pay attention to how they're reacting to the way that you coach, the things that you're doing. And it's hard because you have to figure out, you know, what's going to be best for the team, but also keep all the kids engaged, keep them moving forward developmentally. But if coaches were to understand a lot more about how these things develop or how they can help them develop these skills, you know, they think, oh, it's not my job, you know, that's for someone else to develop this kid. But talk about an opportunity to really be able to help them, not only their performance, but also developmentally. And usually they go hand in hand.
For sure. Absolutely. You know, and I think that that speaks to sort of the larger sports system in which we don't actually value coaches in the way that we should. And that contributes to why somebody thinks it's somebody else's, you know, why coaches can think it's somebody else's job to do that, because they're only, you know, they're a volunteer, maybe they're only working with a young person for a short amount of time. Maybe a young person has reached a certain age when they get to them that they sort of think they should already know that. All of those things, if we invested more in coaches in terms of resources, in terms of education, in terms of really expecting more from them, knowing what the potential outputs can be from that, you know, the potential that of how we can contribute to a young person's development, if we matched those up, then I think coaches would have a lot, you know, then we could, it would be much easier for us to expect coaches to do the same for their young people. But we don't invest in them in the way that we could. And to your point, I think we're missing a huge opportunity.
So thank you for the setup to the Center for Healing and Justice through Sport. So can you tell us about what you do for them and what the mission and vision and the operations are for the center and all the good work you're doing?
Yeah, you know, generally our work sort of starts and ends with coaches and believing in the potential that they have to really impact young people in a positive way and giving them the tools and resources that they need for to do that. And knowing that coaches don't sort of operate without the influence of systems. And so in addition to doing a lot of coach training and a lot of consulting to organizations that work with coaches and young people, we also have a whole group of folks on our team who are looking at sort of collective action around system change in youth sport, system change in sport more broadly, so that we avoid things like what's going on with the NWSL right now, or we avoid things like the sort of continued disinvestment in physical education and sport more broadly in schools, and sort of closing the resource gap and access to sport, which is very much determined. You know, elite sport is very dependent on the resources you have to be able to access it. And so that means that it's available to some kids and not others. And so how do we advocate for changes in the systems that support coaches and athletes so that we have more oversight, so that we have more opportunities to reach more kids, and particularly the kids who need it the most?
With that, so that National Women's Soccer League has had some, I don't know if we're in the courts yet, or allegations of abuse, maltreatment. Mm-hmm. Do you want to?
Yeah, a pretty substantial report from the independent investigator around how pervasive the toxic environments caused in some cases by coaches and in other cases by club and organizational staff have been.
Yeah. Yeah. And Megan and I have talked about this, you know, at length that anyway, I guess what I want to do here, Megan, is think about trauma is, again, not just a physical, sexual, emotional, or psychological abuse or maltreatment, but it certainly can be, but mm-hmm. trauma is also different too. And those things are certainly can be traumatic as well.
For sure. But
trauma is not just or only abuse or maltreatment.
That's right. That's right. And one of the other areas that I think we is sort of less understood through the lens of trauma is that another thing that all the evidence sort of supports that is traumatic for many people is the experience of being a minority in a majority culture, the experience of being othered. There are other significant issues going on in some of these toxic environments that are connected to racism, that are connected to obviously misogyny, that are connected to homophobia, that are connected to things that are to people who are already often marginalized in a larger societal experience. If you are constantly feeling excluded on your team because of one of those things, then that can also be a really traumatic experience. And I know, you know, in sport, we have a long history of sort of locker room violence with a capital V or small V in a way that is exclusionary and can be really traumatic for young people.
Yeah, specifically maybe hazing. You know, bullying,
exactly. Those kinds of things.
And we're thinking about folks that show up with fewer resources to be less resilient, bounce back because of that history that you talked about earlier. They don't have the built up sort of support. And so when they experience an environment, and we've talked about sociology or sociocultural aspects and microaggressions and other, you know, forms of oppression or isms and other just harmful sorts of behaviors that lead to negative outcomes and correlate with all sorts of biopsycho negative effects.
Right.
Yeah. Can you speak to the Center for Healing, Justice and Sport, like when we think about all the words in that too, healing and justice through sport, it's not just dealing with trauma, rather the Center for Dealing with Trauma, it's healing and justice. You know, that would strike, I think, a lot of us kind of as unique perhaps, or odd, right? To use different words. So what's that all about?
Well, I hope it's aspirational.
That's good.
Yeah. I think, you know, my team and I have been focused on working in communities where young people don't have as many resources as kids in other communities do. And that is deeply tied up in things like you just mentioned, right? We sort of feel like you can't separate the two, right? If we're really going to create healing-centered spaces for young people, they also have to be more just spaces. They also have to deal with all the ways in which injustice does contribute to the traumatic experiences that young people have. One of the things that many of us who love sport and believe in its power genuinely believe is that it can be a level playing field in a way that other things can't. And so if we really want to allow it to meet its potential to do that, then we have to consider all of those injustices that young people face and how they show up so that we can have that more universal experience.
Yeah. So as we might say, sports builds character. It also builds trauma and the trick.
Well, right? It can, right? Sport can. Done well builds character. Exactly. And sport done badly can be harmful. Absolutely. Yeah.
And what is the difference between sport done well and not
sport done not well? Yeah. You know, I think so much of it comes down to the sort of safety that a young person feels in their sport. And I believe that is an core to performance too, right? And so I think sport done well is sport in which a young person feels safe enough to try new things, right? Because that's how they're going to get better at skills. That's how they're going to get better at, that's how they're going to build character. That's how they're going to do all the things they need to do in order to be successful, both in the sport and in taking the skills that they learn while they're doing the sport somewhere else. Because a stressed brain doesn't learn. Right. Mm-hmm. So if you are feeling unsafe, which is what your stress response is telling you are, your stress response is saying, that's a threat. This is a threatening environment for me. If you're unsafe, then you're not going to learn new skills. You're not going to make connections. You're not going to do the things that you need to do in order to thrive in that environment. And so for me, at a foundational level, it comes back to that safety, which is mediated almost entirely by the relationships, right? It's by how supported you feel by your coaches. And that doesn't mean, you know, sometimes with a name like the Center for Healing and Justice Through Sport, some people think we're the kumbaya people, right? And that's really not what it, you know, that's really not what it is. We believe very, very strongly that skill development is youth development, and that seeing yourself get better at things matters, and that learning how to win and learning how to lose and learning how to really compete. And to your point earlier, Dr. G, move yourself up and down that continuum in a way that helps you perform when you need to, right? There are going to be other parts of your life where you're going to need to be able to perform, but those are rooted in how safe are you, and how safe you feel is rooted in how connected you are with the people who help make you feel safe.
Beautiful. So now, right, I got practice in 2.5 hours.
Okay, great.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I got maybe 20-ish or so 13, 14-year-olds, 8th graders coming to practice in 2.5 hours.
Yeah. Don't crush them.
How do I not crush them? How do I get them to feel safe? Or this is tackle football. Yeah. For many of them, it's their first or second year. Most of them now second year. What's your advice to me now as we're talking about these kind of issues? If I'm just going to practice today thinking about these things, and I'm also concerned to make sure that we tackle.
And tackle safely.
Tackle safely, right? We talk about heads up, proper positioning, wrap up, also avoiding and reading and blocking so that we don't hurt ourselves. We also don't intentionally hurt the other player, and we protect the people on our team, the guys on our team. So, you know, how do I take the kind of clues or the work that you might do and be safe and building good resilience and coping with the stress and all the stuff that they're bringing with them to practice?
So a lot of different things come to mind. One for sure is you want to be as predictable as you can be. And that can look like even just saying, hey, at practice, here are the things we're going to do, so you know they're coming, right? But it also looks like, how predictable are you, Dr. G, for them, right? How do you respond? How do you respond to stressful situations, right? And I think a lot of us know this from, certainly from sport, but even from work environments or other relationships with humans, is that people who you don't know how they're going to react to you are the people who are the least safe in your life, right? They're the people who create toxic environments, right? When someone is unpredictable at the top, that is really hard to manage, because there's clearly a power differential and you are feel like you're walking on eggshells all this time, then you don't feel safe, right? Because you can't predict how that person's going to react. And so, you know, some people are like, oh, so you're the healing and justice through sport people, so just like no yelling in sport, right? And it's like, well, ideally, yeah, let's cut back on the yelling for yelling's sake, for sure. But more importantly, if you're going to yell, be the kind of person who always yells the same way, right? Because when a young person knows that's what's coming, that's much more safe than not knowing what's coming.
It's funny. I had a conversation, a quick one, with my son here. He plays on team, and we were having dinner a few weeks ago, but maybe even a week ago too. My daughter had left. She just left her dance team, which I considered, from what I saw and heard, to be very toxic.
Yeah.
And I was fine with her leaving, and I actually encouraged her to think through that and do that, and supported that decision. Okay. And I asked Liam at that point too, after we heard about what their coaches and their team was up to, I said, all right, well, how would you describe my coaching then, you know, to my son? And he said, you know, you yell at us sometimes, but you yell at us when we don't do the things that we need to be doing, you know, to be accountable or to be safe or to perform. It's not like you're just yelling or putting us down to just to do it, you know, or I'm not doing that to motivate them. It's like, you know, we need to be careful. We need to be safe. We need to execute these things, because we can get you hurt. We can get the other team hurt. We can get us hurt, or we keep on doing these things, you know, and we're goofing around, or we're not being accountable at practice. And that's the things that you tend to get upset about.
Yeah. That he can articulate that is a huge, you know, check in the box of good coaching, I think. And I think the challenge is really when, no one's surprised, right? But I think, and even the way you describe it is you're giving the why.
Yeah.
Right. And so few coaches give the why, right? Or too many coaches don't give the why. It's sort of like, we're going to do this because, and the because is I said so. You're saying the because is we have to be careful we don't get hurt. We have to be careful we don't hurt the other team. We have to, you know, practice when we have to be focused and when we can let up a little bit, right? And that why is also part of that predictability, right?
The more I've coached too at this level, and I hear other coaches yelling questions at kids. Why did you do that?
And I sit there and what's wrong with you? That's my favorite. Right.
And I just sit there and go, guys, you got to be a little bit more reflective than that. Like, you got to realize that these are kids, especially at this age, doing what they kind of have learned through media, through the coachings to do. Totally. They're not processing, you know, running into each other or making bad plays. Like, they need your help for that. That's what you're there for. Like, yelling questions at them like that is not, like, I understand that you get frustrated. And I put it on my game notes too. Like, why are you going in this direction? Why did you take these steps? What were you thinking about this time, to get them to regulate and be reflective about it? And I might put it in all caps on paper afterwards and give it to them. But, you know, during the time, it's usually not like that, because it's just not effective either.
Well, and that's the thing, is that in those moments when everybody is escalated, asking a question, particularly an accusatory question to a young person in that moment, is just yelling, right? Their survival mode is turned up. And that means that this part, access to your cortex, is shrunk right? It's harder to access your cortex when this part of your brain is going off. And that's when that part of the brain is going off, when you just made a mistake. You think those kids don't know they made a mistake? Of course they do. So their survival brain goes off and says, I know I made a mistake, or the other team scored and that feels like a threat. And all of those things are happening. And so we know they're not good at answering in those moments, even if for some reason, you know, even if they could totally understand the question, they're going to have a much better, more thoughtful answer when they're able to.
I got to share another one that just happened. You just triggered it for me too, is that I stole this from, I heard this when I was a grad student, I think, in sports psychology at Tennessee. And we were talking about Ken Revisa, who is a well-to-do sports psychologist. And one of the things that Ken Revisa used to do, and I worked in baseball too, was he used to say to baseball players, like, flush it. And he used to kind of, I guess, had a little device in the dugout at one of the teams, like they flush the toilet, right? Flush it, flush it. And so I talk to kids sometimes about that. And you got to have a short memory. We can talk about the Finding Nemo too. And Dory, right, has the short memory. Beat a goldfish. Yeah. And so we're at the game a couple of weeks ago and we had a bad play and I'm yelling out on the field, right? This is me yelling too. But I'm yelling, flush it, just flush it, move on. And the referees apparently had never really heard that one before too. Yep. And so they start laughing. And the referee looks over at me, he's laughing. And then the parents behind me start laughing, you know, and he's like, flush it. I like that one. And now, right now we just brought everybody down with a little bit of humor too, right? Okay. And hopefully redirect them to something that's more task relevant anyway, you know, and get them refocused and move on with it.
Exactly. You know? Yeah. And I think that's, you know, this idea of having a mistake ritual, of having a way to reset just generally is so important. And it can be, you know, we have in sport, there are so many places where we naturally build these rituals and routines in, right? Everybody who's shooting a foul shot in a, you know, sort of loud opposing gym knows that how important it is to spin the ball three times and put their feet exactly where they want it and do all the things that they need to do. And some kids need that more than just in those situations, right? And so how do we give the tools that we know are good for focusing in high pressure situations, the tools that are good at helping kids just reset? How do we give them to kids in more situations than just those? And I think that's one of the idea that we all need to reset every once in a while, the ideal, and that some kids need it more than others, and that, like, it's okay to just say, I need 30 seconds to get my stuff together. Those are tools that kids can take with them too.
Yeah, they're used certainly in and outside of sport. And I think if coaches, you do a lot of planning before you go out on the field. I think there's a lot of coaches that go out there and rely on the way that they were coached or the way they thought they were coached also, where, the things that were yelled at them, they're yelling as well. And they don't know why. And they don't know, you know, that's just what you do. This is sport. And so understanding that these skills that you're teaching that are going to help them in life will actually help them perform better as well. So it's not that the time suck that it takes. I mean, I get that all the time from coaches. Oh, I don't have time for that. I got to do all these drills and all this conditioning. And we only get, 5 hours a day. I mean, it's ridiculous how much time they get. But if you stop and really think about what those skills, if you were to teach them, what it would do to their game, and instead of just focusing on we got to win, and to win we need, A, B, and C skill, it might open up a lot for a lot of coaches.
Absolutely. I think one of the dramatically underused interventions in sport are the kinds of things that we do to, like, warm up for games. We play catch, we do, like, when I coached college soccer, we had something called vitamins, and you did it every day because you take your vitamins, right? It's the way that you warm up. You're with a partner, you're tossing to your partner, they're volleying it back to you, left foot, right foot, left thigh, right thigh, chest, head, right, the whole up and down the body thing. And it's a way to transition to practice, it's a way to get warmed up, it's good, but it's also useful because it's good for your touch, and you need good touch, right? Yeah. Or in lacrosse, throwing the ball against the wall, right? Playing mm-hmm. wall ball is good because it helps you with your throwing and your catching, which mm-hmm. lacrosse is sort of one of those high skill barrier to entry sports. And those are things that we use as sort of warm-ups or, you know, sort of to warm up ourselves physically, but they're also incredibly regulating and good for de-escalating somebody who's beyond where they should be, right? And so instead, what we tend to do is sort of isolate and contain them, go sort of sit over there and cool off. Mm-hmm. And never in the history of calming down has anybody ever calmed down by being told
just
to
relax, Megan. Just right? relax. That always happens, right?
Yeah. But what does calm you down is if you get to play catch with somebody. Yeah. What does calm you down is if you go through this routine that is, again, building on your skills, right? It is a skill development intervention in the same way that it's a regulating intervention. And those things, they all exist in and around sport. It's just how you use them. And so we had a coach that we worked with here in Boston, who is a lacrosse coach, and bringing lacrosse into communities that haven't historically played lacrosse. And he created what he called the zone, which was not a technical, you know, he drew some chalk on a pavement, but it was a zone where anybody who had, there were three rules. If you wanted to go to the zone at any time during practice, you could, and you just throw the ball against the wall until you're ready to come back to practice. The second rule was Coach Pat could send you to the zone if he thought you needed 30 seconds in the zone to throw the ball against the wall before you come back. And the third rule was you could take a teammate with you to the zone if you thought that teammate needed it, or if you needed your teammate to go with you to nice. The zone. And then Pat would also do things like take the whole team, you know, stop practice and everybody goes to the zone, or he'd send himself to the zone sometimes during practice, right? And it was just this normalizing that people need resets, that it's okay, and incorporating a skill building activity so it doesn't feel like you're taking a timeout, which is what you're doing, right? You're taking a productive timeout. But to me, what's so special about that is that kids have the option. Right, because the other thing that we do in sport too often is control everything. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so when young people get to opt in, when young people have control over their own experience, you know, I always feel weird when I say it this way, but my favorite definition of trauma is that trauma is the wrenching away of control when you need it the most. Mm-hmm. And every time we then give control back, those are healing moments.
Well, thank you so much, Megan. Yeah, we really appreciate you coming on. We hope you'll come on again. We've got so much more to talk about, and we probably could do a whole nother hour on control and power. I know G would love to, but we do hope you'll come on, and we should probably start scheduling that now.
Exactly.
We've so enjoyed the conversation.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening. Make sure to leave us a 5-star review and hit the follow button, because there's more sport knowledge on the way. If you're interested in more information or want to engage in further conversation about these and other issues in sport, visit our website at spknmedia.com. To stay updated on all things SPKN, follow us on social media at spknmedia or email us at team@spknmedia.com, and we'll be happy to welcome you to the SPKN community.